Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkeying around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go where we want to, do what we like to do. The only time to get restless, there's always something new.
And good evening. It's May 23rd, 2007. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio Network. Our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen live or you can download the podcast of the current show or any of my commentaries. We're also on Channel 46 on Trust Cable in Alabama and on satellite virtual channel W3957 or wherever you're hearing us. It's nice to have you tonight. Gloria Denton will join me. Her daughter April Beth Pitzer is missing, and we're going to talk to her about that. After that, the pistol-toting granny of the Minuteman Project, Carmen Mercer, will be here from Washington, D.C. to talk about that immigration bill. And then Robert Peters, who's the president of Morality and Media, will be here to talk about movies where glamorized smoking scenes can lead to R ratings. Violent scenes can't be. So we're going to talk about the media with Robert Peters, who is the president of the Morality in Media organization. That's tonight here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. It's nice to have you.
To patch it up, baby, before we fall apart at the seams. We got to patch it up, baby. We can't let time unravel our dream. Let's go back and touch the past. One more night is all I ask. Get that feeling. can patch it up, baby. Patch it up with a whole lot.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. If you've been following the news lately, like I have been, you'll scratch your head and you'll wonder what's going on when it comes to the recent immigration bill that's being considered in Washington. Is it amnesty? Isn't it amnesty? What the heck is the the United States government coming to? I thought I'd bring back the VP of the Minuteman Project, Carmen Mercer, who is in Washington, I believe, to talk about that. Hi, Carmen.
Hiya, Dana. Yes, I am. I have been in Washington, D.C. since Sunday, actually, and we came to see the closure vote on Monday. And, of course, we've been going from one Senate office to the next, trying to convince the senators that this is an amnesty bill and that we cannot accept that. And certainly we were also aware of the phone calls and the support from the American public coming in. And literally the assistant of the senators were literally pulling their hair out because they said, gosh, is this going to stop we've never seen anything like that. And of course, you know, we told him, I said, we are quite aware of what's going on, and that is the effect that you're getting, or that the senator is getting, by trying to push a bill through that is totally unacceptable, that is a total amnesty bill for us.
When you and I talked a few months back, did you ever figure that something like this would be considered? This is taking a lot of people by surprise.
That the bill was going to be tried to push through?
The bill that's set... The way that the bill is set up now with this Z visa and all of this, it's really confusing people and it's outraging a lot.
Exactly. And a lot of people really didn't understand the bill. A lot of people didn't know anything about the cloture vote. And so it is confusing. And the bill is now up to about 1,000 pages. It started out with about 300 and some pages, and it's up to about 1,000 pages. And Dana, my concern is, you know, when these senators have to read the bill and understand it, and I've only had a printout of about 5 pages of the bill, and it only contains very few items in there. But if the senators are starting to read this bill, I'm afraid that some of the important issues are going to be pushed in right about at the end of the bill, because by then everybody's so exhausted trying to understand the darn bill that they won't give attention to the rest anymore, you know, and something else might be sliding in there. I just found out today that there's a clause in there that people who belong to drug cartel gangs, all they have to do is denounce their drug gang, and they are going to get the workers' permit or the pass to the citizenship. I mean, that is ridiculous. What are we doing? I mean, what else can we do? How much more damage can we do?
Well, that's absolutely amazing, and I think that's what's most confusing to people is when the government comes out to speak on this bill, they're talking about how this is an amnesty, yet it is as amnesty as plain as the nose on your face. Tell the folks a little bit, Carmen, about what this bill is all about and why we're all so upset about it.
Well, first of all, I think it's a slap in the face for people like myself, who I am, as you know, I am a legal immigrant. I've been a very proud citizen of the United States of America since 1999, and I certainly have waited in line. And people like us who are legal immigrants, who are citizens, don't need a bill like this because we do not break the law. This bill is only there for people who are breaking the law, for people who are trying to get into this country the illegal way. And we certainly should not reward them with the pass to citizenship by having them pay a fine. We certainly don't need any additional visas. You know, and we heard Senator Boxer today make the suggestion that we will give out these visas, and then when we realize that the visas are being overstayed, then we are terminating the program. We don't need these kind of visas. We already have visas that people are overstaying, and we cannot keep control of those. We have the laws already on the books. We do not need to create new laws for this.
Let's talk from the perspective of the border issue. The Minutemen have been working very hard to try and protect the borders, something that the government of the United States hasn't been doing. They've tried to step it up a little bit lately, but we haven't heard much more. I understand there was a Border Patrol agent killed here the other day. We have Border Patrol agents serving jail time for crimes that they have alleged to have committed, yet drug dealers are given amnesty. Let's talk about that whole aspect, Carmen.
True. Of course, you probably have heard the story of the two Border Patrol agents, Compion and Ramos, who have been put in jail and who are now serving a 11-year or 12-year sentence for something, for doing their job, for doing exactly what the government has been asking them to do, what the president has been asking them to do. And they're now being blamed for supposedly shooting a drug dealer in the behind, trying to confiscate the contraband from the drug dealer. And, of course, we've heard many, many stories about this incident. We've also heard the story that the drug dealer, the way he was shot, could have only come from a left-handed person. And the two Border Patrol agents were not left-handed person, but the drug dealer himself was a left-handed person. And according to statements made by his own mother, who said that he would never leave the house without a weapon. Of course, the weapon was not found, but it could have very well been thrown away prior to it. And, you know, and then for the government trying to find the person in Mexico and bring him back. And, of course, the outcome of it is that he is now trying to sue the United States of America. I mean, how ridiculous can this be? What does it do to the moral of the Border Patrol agents? Yes, and the violence is increasing. You're right. A Border Patrol agent was just shot about 2 days ago, and I did not get the full story on this yet because, like I said, we've been busy going to the Senate building and trying to make the importance to the senators that this bill cannot be accepted, that this bill means that that the Americans, that comprehensive means always to us unlimited amnesty. And we will even have a greater flow of immigrants coming into this country, and we will have a greater displacement of the American workers that way.
One of the biggest confusions in the whole immigration aspect and what's reported on television and in the media are the numbers of illegal immigrants in the country. Sometimes you'll hear 10 million, sometimes you'll hear 11 million, 12 million. With the bill the way that it is proposed, is it even remotely possible to try and enact what they're asking for, or are there just too many illegals here?
Well, I think, for us it is, taking the magnet away would be much, much more important, and holding the employers accountable for breaking the law as well. We've been fed by the government that we have about 11 million illegal aliens in this country, and this number hasn't changed in the last 5 years. I mean, that's the number we have been hearing, but according to the Border Patrol, of course, there are many more than that, and still, according to the Border Patrol, they only are able to apprehend 1 out of 4. And let's just say that some of the illegal aliens are coming through twice. You know, they're being apprehended, they get pushed back, put back into Mexico, into their country, and then they're returning again. But still, we are still having more than just a million illegal aliens a year that are being apprehended by Border Patrol. And now, of course, with the new bill, we are supposed to build new jails so that we can detain more people. And we've already seen it in the past that when the Border Patrol has reached their quota, when their jails are full, then they're being told, hey, guys, you cannot apprehend any more of the illegal aliens. And what does that do? That just brings us into greater danger, because already now the government has no control who's coming into this country and how many are coming into this country. And now they're going to be giving them a quick background check. They're not going to get a thorough health check, which they need to get, because let's face it, disease is coming, folks. We are having diseases entering our schools that have been eradicated at one time or another, and they're coming back, and they're coming back in a stronger strain that is very much harder to cure.
When it comes to the so-called sanctuary cities that we hear about in the media and the illegals that are flooding there, how does a bill like this even affect or try to control something like that when you have cities, mayors, and police departments that aren't enforcing the law the way they should be?
You know, there is no law that will allow you to have a sanctuary city. Those are rules and laws that mayors make up in their own city, because they're really not existing on the books anywhere. So that's an illegal action already taken by them right there. And yes, how are they going to apply the new bill if the illegal aliens are claiming we are having sanctuary? Exactly. Where is that supposed to take an effect?
The Minuteman Project has seen some negativity brought to it, some university campuses and in the media. I want to get your comment, Carmen, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, how is the morale, so to speak, and how is the strength of the Minuteman Project now with all of this going on? You must be very busy.
Yes, we are. And actually, the Minuteman Project, who is led by Jim Gilchrist, they have been the ones encountering problems at the university. The Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, which we are actually the original border security group, we have Chris has done a lot of speaking engagements at the universities, and I just traveled through Texas with him to do some to join him in some of the speaking engagements, because we have a program where we want to involve all the students at all the campuses. We want to build little or mini Minuteman chapters on the campuses. And when we were at the CPAC meeting in Washington, D.C., we had a great response to the program. and we had 57 universities sign up who want us to come there and do speaking engagements, and that's what we started doing. And I certainly need to help out with that, because the amount of universities coming around is tremendous. And so Chris, of course, told me, he said, you need to be aware of what can be going on. You need to be aware, just because it has been peaceful in the past doesn't mean that it's going to be going on like that. So then I went with him to Austin and also to San Antonio. And, yes, we had two incidents. And, of course, he also had an incident in New York where the opponents were starting to become aggressive and even violent to a certain point. And, you know, I was the one standing in the back and listening. And when you listen to these protesters, they very often don't even know who Chris Simcox is. Mm-hmm. And one of the groups were shouting, let him in, let him in, we want to see him. And he was already standing right in the middle amongst them. And so you're wondering what their purpose is. Their purpose is not to give a reasonable argument. Their purpose is just to be protesting and to be hateful and to be distractive, and that's it. And so there's not much to bargain with them. I mean, you make your point, and in the university in Austin, of course, we saw it. You know, they came in with aggression, and they stood and had their arms folded over their chests, and after about an hour, they actually sat down and they listened to what Chris had to say. And I think he was able to show them that we're not racist, that we're not hateful, that we're just as concerned about the people who are perishing in the desert, because it is a dangerous trip for them. And so, you know, they were beginning to realize that maybe they had received the wrong information.
What's the Washington timeline? And what I mean by that, Carmen, is how long are you planning to be there? I know until you get the job done, or at least you get your word out. But what is the Washington timeline as far as what the people should be looking for?
Well, I'm going to be here until Saturday, actually through Friday. And we have gone through all of the Republican senators' offices so far. Tomorrow we're going to do the rest of the Democratic ones, and on Friday as well. And what we actually want to do, Dana, we will try to get a personal conference with some of the major senators, the Republican ones, whom we will try persuade in their decision, because we need about another 10 more senators for the next closure vote. And so what we're trying to do is get a conference with the senators personally next Wednesday or Thursday, because on Friday of next week, the vote will happen, and we want to make sure that we have as many senators on our side as we can get. So I will be going home Saturday and then hopefully come back that following Wednesday and put up another fight for Wednesday, Thursday until Friday then, and hopefully have a good amount of senators on our side who will not be voting for this amnesty bill.
Just before I let you go, Carmen, a lot of, you know, the people, they get their information from the media. The media, as you know, can spin things different ways. There's a strong liberal bias in the media. Are you satisfied with how this issue is being reported? Could it be done better? What are your thoughts?
Well, it always can be done better, and this is why I really like radio shows, because you're right on the air, and nothing can be edited out, and you get to say what you want to say. But the media is certainly realizing, and of course you've seen it in the last year and a half, or in the last 2 years since we have turned into the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps. Of course, 5 years ago is when we started, and we were a neighborhood border watch group, and we have since then grown into almost 9,000 volunteers. So, yes, the media can still get better, but let's face it, every day you turn on the television, and it doesn't matter what channel you turn it on, there is talk about immigration, and there is talk about immigration laws and enforcing the border, securing the border, and building the fence. And so, you know, it has grown to the point where we wanted to have it. It is in everybody's brain, so to speak, and everybody knows about it. And, of course, our elected officials especially know about it, how important it is to make that right decision and to worry and be concerned about national security and about public safety of the American people. That's the bottom line.
And that's what it's all about. Carmen, you're doing a great job. You're always welcome on the program. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Dana. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye. That's Carmen Mercer. She's the VP of the Minuteman Project. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Oh, Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. If you're listening to us on Channel 46 on Trust Cable in Alabama on satellite virtual channel W3957 at scaredmonkeys.com/radio, live or on the podcast, whatever. It's always nice to have you. April Beth Pitzer was last seen in the vicinity of the 30,000 block of Caspian Way in New Springs, California. She told her roommate that she was leaving on a bus to visit her mother in Arkansas, but she never arrived. Pitzer had been a model for a variety of clothing stores in Arkansas and Texas. She left behind two young daughters who she reportedly doted upon. In December 2005, clothing was found in a mine shaft in Ludlow, California. In January 2006, April's mother positively identified the clothing as belonging to her daughter. There was no other sign of April at the scene. April has a medical condition and requires medication. You can find out more information at the Texas Equisearch website and other places. In fact, just Google April Beth Pitzer, P-I-T-Z-E-R. I have April's mom, Gloria Denton, on the phone with me. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, Dana.
Nice to have you on the air. It's always difficult, and I've interviewed many parents that have missing children. And, gull darn it, they're your children, no matter if they're one or they're 101, they're still your daughter. I'm looking at a picture here of a beautiful young lady. This is a tragedy. This is something that I want to talk to you about, both about the case and your thoughts as a parent, because sometimes we don't hear a lot from the parents as far as how it's affecting them. But let's talk about April, what kind of gal she is, and what led to her disappearance.
Okay. Well, April loved life, Dana. She was so sweet. I mean, she had such a good heart and soul, and never met a stranger. And she was having marital problems. She was married to a millionaire's son, and she went to work and met some people there at work who, April was just, you know, she had never been anywhere to speak of, never been away from the girls. And, these girls, and, they talked April in, said, well, you need to put some distance between you and him and make them appreciate you. And, you know, and April being as gullible as she could be at times, and she was like, okay. So she told Chase that she was going to go to California and going to check things out down there, and that she wanted him to take care of the girls, which I'm so glad she left the girls, because I wouldn't have them either. I'm certain they'd be gone.
Exactly.
And so she got out there, and California wasn't at all, especially the area she ended up in, was not the Hollywood that you picture California with.
Right.
And they, at some point in time, they got in. She was left. They were visiting some people, and they left April there at that house, and so April was dependent on people she had never met before.
Mm-hmm.
And God love her, she didn't want her in-laws to down her all the more. She had recently been diagnosed as bipolar, and that was where it all fell apart. They wouldn't even take her to get her medication. I had to drive 2 hours to pick her up to take her 15 minutes from her house, because in their social world, that was an embarrassment. And so she, you know, she just didn't want to be belittled anymore. Now, I didn't know this in the beginning. She just carried on like everything was okay. And I never felt like it was, but she just kept on assuring me that but there's just, you know when you're a mom that things just aren't like they, you know when something's wrong with your child. I don't care how old or you know, they are.
Yep.
And so she finally met an elderly lady named Barbara Killebrew, who was very handicapped, and April broke down and told Barbara the truth, and Barbara said, April, you got to call your mother. Your mother would want to know this. You need to tell your mom. And so she called me, and it just broke my heart to find out that she had been basically living on the street for a long time. Whoever would give her a helping hand. And so this guy that she referred to as Uncle Chuck, he was supposed to take her to the bus station for
right.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And the newspaper got a little bit mixed up. She never made it to the bus station. He never got her there. And he is dead now. He died last September with cancer. We begged him to his last breath, but he stood true to his word that he knew nothing. You know, he never at all. And there was a guy named Dan Damsbury that was friends with Chuck, and he lived in a trailer on Chuck's property. And he was a Vietnam vet, which, you know, I admire all of our soldiers. They go through a lot, and some came back a little messed up.
Right.
And he did. And we all believe that he knows what happened to my daughter, that he very well knows what happened to April. And her clothes were found, when she first disappeared, Barbara called me. This is how it all came about. Barbara called me and told me, asked me, was I glad to have April home? And I'm like, what? She said, aren't you happy to have your daughter home,
mm-hmm.
your baby? I said, Barbara, April's not home. And she said, sure she is. You know, she thought I was kidding with her.
Right.
No, ma'am.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, and I just want to share some of these facts with my audience. At the time of her disappearance, April was 30 years of age, obviously female,
right.
white, 69 inches in height, 125 pounds, hair color brown, eye color hazel, complexion medium. Pay attention to these identifying characteristics. A small round scar on the left side of chest, scar on elbow, scar on lip. She wears size 6 athletic shoes or sandals, and she is known to wear gold hoop earrings. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of April Beth Pitzer, call the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department at 760-256-4838. When did you first know, Gloria, and we talk about this, I call it a sixth sense. I've interviewed mothers, Beth Holloway, Twitty, and included,
right.
where they know that something is wrong, and you mentioned that too. How do you explain that? Is it just something, it's your flesh and blood, you're the mother, you have okay. that maternal instinct?
Mm-hmm. Whenever on July the 4th, we'll see, we were moving from Texas back to Arkansas, and I'd been calling that phone number over and over and over. And I couldn't get an answer. I couldn't get an answer. And then on July the 4th, I got a hold of Barbara, and that was when she was telling me, well, you know, April left. And I told her, I said, no. And I knew right then, I said, Barbara, something's wrong. Something has happened to April. And I kept calling that phone number, the only phone number I had there where she was supposed to be, and finally... And the police wouldn't do anything at that point in time because, number one, she was an adult and, having marital problems and was out here. She just decided not to come home. And then bipolar, well, we could, you know, if we look for everybody that is bipolar, we'd never get any real cases solved. You know, that was the attitude.
Right.
And so finally on July the 16th, I got a phone call from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department, and Barbara had successfully filed a missing person for me. And because she was the last one where April had resided. And so they gave her the okay. She just got lucky, I say. Somebody listened to her. And then they contacted me right away. And then I made contact finally with that Chuck, like on the 18th or 19th of July. And he told me that he'd been helping a friend move, and he told me that April was waiting on the ticket to get there, and that she took, and this always struck me. You know, I've always wondered about this. He said, Gloria, she took two changes of clothes and her ID. And right off the bat, I thought, why are you telling me she took her ID? You know, did you do away with it, you know?
Right.
And so I said, well, where's her stuff? Oh, it's all here. I'm looking at it right now. And I said, well, Chuck, I'm coming to California. Please don't do anything with her stuff. I want it. And he said that, you know, it'll be here when you get here. So I immediately called the first detective, Marie Spain, and I said, he answered the phone and he told me he's at home. So she went over there, knocked on the door, well, actually the gate. He came out to this gate and unlocked it and talked to her and told the detective that April, that he had went to work that morning and April was asleep in her bedroom. And when he returned home that evening, about 5 p.m., that April was gone and all of her belongings were gone. And that contradicted what he had told me. And so the detective said, well, can I come in and look around? And he wouldn't let her.
Right.
And she couldn't force him, you know. And he couldn't get a search warrant either. And because as far as they knew, he was telling the truth that last time he seen April, she was, you know, in the bed. And, you know, April had come out there and lived off the street, and, you know, maybe she just run away.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept, you know, I told him, no, that's, you know, not true. He wouldn't do this. We talked every day. I mean, every day. And she called them girls and told those girls good night, good morning. I mean, it was almost like she wasn't gone because we talked so much.
Right.
And so then they didn't do anything, and about 6 weeks later, another detective went out there and talked to Chuck, and he's like, okay, truth is, April met a truck driver. Here's her stuff here. She said she'd be back to get it in 3 weeks, that she was going to have this truck driver to take her back to Arkansas so her mom didn't have to pay for a ticket back. And then, I mean, by then, I knew, and I will always believe in my heart, he knows something. You know, I believe he carried it to his grave.
Have you had any recent contact with the Sheriff's Department? Is the investigation still open?
Yes, I have an awesome detective now, Steve Pennington, and he's with the San Bernardino County Homicide Division, Sheriff's Department. April's case was upgraded to missing / homicide. They firmly believe that April failed a foul play. And he has just, on his own time, he goes out and searches through those mines. And Mike Nelson, a wonderful man, Tim Miller knows him real well. Mike helped him with searches. And he contacted me and said that God had called him to look for the missing, and that April had touched his heart. And Mike has driven just time and time again a 7-hour drive to go down in those mine shafts and walk across the Mojave Desert looking for my daughter.
Wow. You know, that is dedication beyond dedication. Gloria, before, you know, our time is, we're down to 5 minutes here.
Uh-huh.
Before I let you go, I want to talk about you a little bit. I want to talk about the perspective from the parent. Your daughter is missing. Any parent, again, I've talked to them all. Dave Holloway, I remember saying he'd move heaven and earth to find Natalie. Any of us would, and I know you would too. But when that, I guess, reality check hits you, that the investigation has now turned to a homicide investigation, and you know that your daughter may not be coming back to you alive. I hate the term closure, but what would bring a satisfaction to you in the case of your daughter? Obviously, to find out what happened, but let's talk about that a little bit. We miss that when we report these cases, because you're a human being too, and okay. And we want to know how you're feeling.
Okay, and you're right. Closure, there's never closure. The perfect word all of us have decided is resolve.
That's a good one, yeah.
And I know, Dana, that April's not coming home. I have peace with this in my heart. I know that she's moved on. And I'll see April again someday. And I have to stay focused on finding her, her remains, and bringing her home, and keeping her life, you know, her life as meaningful, to dignify her.
Yes.
To honor her in my life. And I can't do that if I let grief overwhelm me. And my heart is broken. I love her. She's the joy of my life. But now I have to fight for her rights. And I have to seek the people that took her from us.
Well, I hope we can help. Your strength is amazing. All of your strengths as parents who have missing children. Again, if you have any information regarding the disappearance of April Beth Pitzer, please call the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department at 760-256-4838. Gloria, I'd like to stay in touch and have you on again sometime soon.
Okay. Dana, I'd also like to mention real quick that there is a $50,000 reward now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And is there, how's the information besides to the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department? Is there another way to get?
It's Let's Bring Them Home. It is an Arkansas-based foundation, and they have started April's Hope, and they have offered the $50,000 for the arrest and conviction. No less than $1,000 and no greater than $5,000 should somebody find April.
Well, we all hope that you'll get the answers that you so rightly deserve, and I want to thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much, Dana, and God bless you for the job you do.
Thank you, Gloria. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
Everybody loves somebody. Somehow, something in your kiss just told me my sometime is now. Everybody finds somebody someplace. There's no telling where love may appear. Something in my heart keeps saying my someplace is here. If I had it in my power, I'd arrange for every girl to have your charm. Then every minute, every hour, every boy would find what I found in your arms. Everybody loves somebody sometime. And although my dream was of you, your love made it worth
their job.
Okay, we're back. I've got Bob Peters with me. He's the president of the organization called Morality and Media. We talked a little bit at the beginning of the show. Can you imagine glamorized smoking scenes in movies that lead to an R rating, yet violent scenes don't? All you have to do is turn on the television, go to a movie, look at the internet. The morality in media, we've talked about codes of ethics and codes of conducts, and just what we're seeing, reading, watching, and hearing has been unbelievable. And it's my pleasure to have Bob Peters with me on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this. You know, every time I hear about something like this, I just shake my head and wonder. Of course, I come from the old school, and if they had an R rating on every movie that I saw when I was growing up where somebody smoked in it, every movie would have an R rating. Every TV show, you name it, right from the Flintstones used to advertise cigarettes to Ozzy and Harriet, but it's a little different situation right now. Tell us about what's going on.
Well, I'd say before, my wife and I watch films made in the 30s and 40s, you know, either on PBS or we rent them. We like them.
Me too, yep.
But I tell you, it's phenomenal how much smoking characters in films in the 30s and 40s did. They didn't curse. They didn't have sex on the stage.
That's right.
But, boy, did they ever smoke.
You bet.
And, you know, I tell you, in preparation for this MPAA thing, I was trying to find some statistics for smoking around 1950, which unfortunately in my limited time I wasn't able to find, but I did come across a statistic for 1964, which indicated that more than half of adult Americans in 1964 smoked, and of course more men than women smoked, so the percentage of men was whatever 60-70% of adult men smoked.
Right.
And in my opinion, one reason so many people smoked was because of the influence of films and later television, because it was just accepted.
Yep.
Now, in recent decades, I think there's a lot less smoking, but every once in a while it starts coming back, and the groups that fight smoking, when it starts coming back, they start putting pressure on Hollywood.
And this term I'm going to use probably doesn't even exist, but I'm going to call it a conglomerization of the media market. We hear about the tobacco companies and the billion-dollar lawsuits because someone, Uncle Joe, died 15 years ago of lung cancer. Is there just a liability issue with motion pictures that they're so afraid that if they do dramatize it, that there may be that lawsuit? Yet, again, we're going to get into the violence aspect of it here in a minute.
Well, I tell you, at one level, in my opinion, there should be some potential liability on the part of the media, but the media have some very good friends on the Supreme Court who have pretty much interpreted the First Amendment to basically give the media virtually a free hand to do anything they want, no matter how many people they harm, directly or indirectly, whether it's violence or sex or smoking or drug use, whatever it is. You know, as soon as somebody sues the media for any sort of arguing that something that someone saw in the media affected behavior, which hurt somebody, etc., they're going to wave the First Amendment flag. And with very few exceptions, these days they will win. So for the most part, the media at this point in time doesn't have an awful lot to fear in terms of getting sued by somebody. But that could change. It could change if we could get at least two more Supreme Court justices that had some common sense. Which I don't believe a majority of the justices now have.
You look at the recent blockbuster in the movie theaters, Spider-Man. Well, Spider-Man is the young families were taking their young children to Spider-Man, and I know the ones that I've talked to and the ones that I've heard from walked away from it and said, you know, this movie really wasn't a movie for children. It wasn't about Spider-Man the way that the young kids look at it. Again, it's a different morality, or I guess a different level of measurement from the parents. But you walk into now Spider-Man turns into a love story where it has graphic violence and gore. Why aren't these movies being rated R?
Well, it's a good question. I suppose one reason they wouldn't be rated R is because they're certainly not, you know, Spider-Man wouldn't be considered unacceptable for high school students. An R rating means that nobody under 17 is supposed to go.
Exactly.
So if they gave it an R rating, it wouldn't just be the little children who couldn't see Spider-Man. It would be high school. Some kids in high school senior wouldn't be able to see it. And, of course, of all the bad things that come out of Hollywood, I don't think Spider-Man ranks, would be ranked up there. You know, on the whole, Spider-Man is a story with some clear right and wrong, and the good guys win and the bad guys get punished like in the old days. So, but, you know, the way the Hollywood, the rating system works, there's only one rating that absolutely keeps anybody out, and that's the R rating. Like a PG-13 rating is an indication that kids 13 and under, whatever it is, probably shouldn't see this, but if they want to see it, they can see it, and if a kid is 6 years old, they can go to a PG-13 film and nobody's going to keep them out. That's the way the rating system works. I mean, the bottom line is that the motion picture industry wants to sell tickets.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to keep the kids away any more than it has to.
Exactly. And there has to be a cusp of responsibility for the parent to decide whether or not, you know, there's nothing wrong with going to screen a movie, parents, before you take your children to it. But, you know, we're going to run out of time here in a minute, Bob, but I want to talk to you a little bit more about morality and media. Rosie O'Donnell, as an example. We talk about free speech and the right to free speech. Another whole issue now on the cable news shows and on the internet, and I'm sure in the papers, about Rosie O'Donnell. What's happening to media? You get a format where you have several million people a day watching, where you can come on and speak a lot of nonsense. And is it because of the public's fascination with this, because now that the advertisers in the IMA situation may step forward, that we may see a change, or are things going to get worse than before they get better?
Well, I'll tell you, there have been, I'd say I've seen maybe close to a handful of disciplinary actions aimed at radio shock jocks since the IMUS incident, I guess you would say. My anticipation is that it's not going to last long.
No.
That, you know, for a while, the radio shock jocks are going to have to watch their step a little bit, but my anticipation would be it'll only be a matter of time before things are pretty much back to normal. I hope I'm wrong about that, but, you know, things tend to go in like a pendulum. You know, it swings one way and back, and the IMUS incident brought the pendulum back in the direction of some responsibility on the part of broadcasters, but God forbid that they would continue to exercise any responsibility. So I wouldn't, for people who love radio shock jocks, at this point, I don't think that they are an endangered species. But, you know, with Rosie O'Donnell, one take I've, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff she says is pretty, you know, far-out opinion and whatnot. But what kind of amazes me that if someone were in the opposite end of the political spectrum and they were making comments like Rosie makes towards people on my side of the political spectrum, they'd be out the door in 1 minute.
Exactly.
If they talked about gays the way she occasionally talks about religious Americans,
yep,
they'd be out the door in the minute. I mean, that's what angers me. I can handle Rosie O'Donnell. I mean, I'm not going to lose any sleep over Rosie O'Donnell. She's a foolish woman, in my opinion. But I just, you know, I just marvel that she is permitted to say the things she says. But let's say get Ann Coulter, and I'm not, you know, a big, big fan of Ann Coulter. But why not put her on The View and let her make some pretty outlandish comments once in a while about people on the other side of the political perspective? You know, Ann Coulter has a platform, but she doesn't have a national talk show on mainstream television where she's there every day of the week. You know, she writes a column and she's invited as a guest, and but she's not invited to be a co-host of a major national program on television. Why not? Why invite Rosie but not Ann Coulter? It's ridiculous. And I mean, I don't want to be, you know, totally equating that. I must confess, I appreciate Ann Coulter I don't appreciate Rosie O'Donnell, but I mean, I sometimes think Ann Coulter crosses the line. So does Rosie O'Donnell. But Rosie has a show, and Ann Coulter doesn't.
If you look at the, again, morality in media, you have to equate that to the morality in public. And with the Jerry Springers and the shock jocks, as you called them, and I called them the same thing, there seems to be that public fascination for this garbage that is broadcast. How do you explain that?
Well, I tell you, I explain it in part that in a nation of 300 million people, you're going to find a market for almost anything. If somebody started, you know, pardon the joke, skinning cats live,
yeah,
you know, every morning at 8 o'clock, I can guarantee you it would have an audience. So, I mean, the fact that something gets an audience doesn't make it right. I mean, you could have a program telling all the funny racial jokes from back in the 20s and 30s. I'm not advocating that, don't get me wrong. But I can guarantee you it would get an audience. You could have gay bashing parties on television. It would get an audience. But those things are never going to see the light of day. One level, thank God. But if you want to have explicit sex and vulgarity and mockery of Christians and all that kind of stuff, Bill Maher, come on, give us more of Bill Maher and his vile, evil talk.
Yeah.
But don't dare put anybody on from the opposite end of the political spectrum to say the same things. It ain't going to happen on television for sure.
Well, that's why Turner Classic Movies is one of my favorite channels. Bob Peters, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have you back soon. Thank you. That's Bob Peters, the president of the Morality in Media. We'll be right back.
Well, in North Carolina, way back in the hill, lived my old pappy and he had him a still. He grew the white lightning till the sun went down, and then you fill him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, pappy's corn squeezing.
Shh, white lightning.
But my pappy kept on cooking.
Whew, white lightning.
And right away I knew that my eyes bugged out and my face turned blue.
All right, that's it. I want to thank my guests this evening, Gloria Denton, Carmen Mercer, and Robert Peters. You've been listening to the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. The show will be available for archive a little bit later on this evening or tomorrow. Go to www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio, www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can pick up podcasts of past shows, listen live, or hear my daily commentary. Thanks a lot. We'll see you again real soon. Good night, everybody.